Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And as always, Peter Breggin is proud to be here, having this show now of many years, hundreds of wonderful guests, hopefully hundreds of wonderful hours for you. I get a chance to talk to most of the people I'd enjoy talking to in my field. It's just an absolute pleasure to be here. And you are the best. Anybody who's going to be turning on the, you know, getting on their computer and listening to the kind of people that come on to this show, including my guest today, is just somebody who really is interested in life and improving things and what's really going on in the world. I wanted to share with you a thought that I had that I've really been mulling on quite a bit, thinking over and over again. And it's about how psychiatric drugs really work. For me, the original model of how psychiatric drugs really work is the model of the antipsychotic drugs, which cut off suppress the basal ganglia dopamine functions. They cause a virtual lobotomy, a true lobotomy. And that leads to what the lobotomists used to talk about as indifference, or shallow emotions, not caring as much. And when the psychiatric drug revolution, so-called, began with the antipsychotic drugs, disinterest was the whole theme. The drugs created disinterest. And the psychiatrists of the time openly thought that was a great idea. Patients were less responsive to their environment, less caring, less reactive. They didn't usually get into less autonomous, but they would say more easily managed on the wards. The nurses loved the new drugs. One of them, Delayer Deniker, one of the pioneers, said they knew right away they had something amazing because in a few hours, the nurses were very pleased with the drug effect. That's how they knew it worked. Well, if we go and quickly just look at the stimulant drugs, what I've discovered and found deeply embedded, actually, in animal research, these drugs crush spontaneity. So now we have the teachers feeling these drugs are terrific. The nurses thought they're terrific for just causing such overwhelming apathy, disinterest. Apathy was a big word used originally. Well, we could use if we didn't just use the term spontaneous and we thought about where does that term fit in? So then we find the stimulants are causing apathy, disinterest, removal, a closing down, less imagination, less creativity. So you pay less attention to your daydreams. You don't, if you're a little girl, you don't daydream out the window. If you're a little boy, you don't poke your neighbor. And then I started looking now at the third great group, the antidepressants. And more, the data is confirming everything I've seen in my practice, which is that they cause indifference. Wives may come in with their husbands. The husband says, well, I do feel better. And the wife says, yeah, he doesn't even care about the dog as much anymore. He didn't care about me. He doesn't even want to make love. And it's not just a sexual dysfunction. He didn't want to. Certainly, you get the same effects with lithium. So what I'm looking at more and more is that it's pretty straightforward that the first and main thing that all psychoactive drugs do, and it's probably the same for alcohol, and probably the same for marijuana, that basically psychoactive substances, in the short run and the long run, they're basically doing something in this whole general category of shutting down humanity, making us careless, apathy, disinterest, not so loving, putting up with things, not knowing or feeling our bad feelings as much, but not knowing or feeling anything as much. And that this overall phenomenon, for which I don't yet have the perfect word, is what the drugs are doing. So that's kind of where I am right now, that there's that if we really set aside the most subtle kinds of distinctions, we end up that all the psychiatric drugs are causing those kinds of phenomena. Well, let you all mull on that for a while. And I'll bring it up again. And I'm trying to think of a way maybe I can have some of you respond, not on the air, but just respond to this idea, because I think this is the most fundamental, basic, important conclusion that one can make from the psychiatric drugs. Jeannie Stolz is my guest. She's also a dear friend. I love her very much. Jeannie, are you there?
I'm here, and I'm so glad I'm here.
Oh, I'm so glad you're there, too. Maybe you can, in a second, comment on what I was just saying. Now, Jeannie Stolzer. Jeannie is spelled J-E-A-N-N-E. Jeannie Stolzer. Jeannie does thing like this. She's a professor of child and adolescent development. How many of them are full of life and love and caring and involvement? Jeannie is the opposite of somebody on drugs. Jeannie T, and I hope I am too, Jeannie, will join that club even at my age. I'm the opposite of somebody on drugs. Jeannie's a professor at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, Nebraska. I've been there. I've given a public university lecture there, met a lot of really great people at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. I think if anybody who's in this general area, that'd be a great place to go as a student and meet Jeannie or as a new instructor. She teaches now. She's teaching infant, child, adolescent development. She does a lot of research. She's got a lot of publications. And she studies things like, you know, believe it or not, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Actually, she searches the hokum surrounding it and what's really going on. And she's deeply into, and I might say courageously into, attachment parenting. Many of her ideas, thank God, go against the current culture. She's interested in all the things that go into the labeling of children. She's challenging, along with me and some other folks now, the pathologizing of normal child development. So she's got these twin aspects that I think govern my life too. One is the caring about what's the best way for people to live, and the other side, the critique of the cultural and medical aspects. I got a frog in my throat, Jeannie. I'm going to get that frog to hop out, and I'm just going to give you the mic for a minute or two.
I can't believe you have a frog in the throat, because I do too. I just, what's going on? I knew I had to tell you this story. Right?
It's not allowed. You got to talk for a couple of minutes.
I got to tell you story that I handed out some research today, and we were looking at Freud's work and Maslow's and Bowlby's and Brigham's. And it hit me as I was walking out of the classroom, I am going to talk to one of the people that I was just teaching about, and that's Peter Brigham. So I can't tell you how glad I am to be here with you. I can't tell you how proud I am to be here with you. I can't tell you how appreciative I am of all of the work that you do. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, dear. Thank you. Thank you for being alive and being my friend and calling me and talking with me, sharing aspects of your life with me.
I loved your little talk about the disinterest, the apathy, the crushing the spontaneity, the disinterest. It's just pervasive. Look what we're doing. And we're doing it to infants, toddlers, and children. We should be in the streets. But do you see, if we can truly induce this pharmacological apathy, no one will be in the streets.
Hopefully they'll be making their lives grow.
That's right. It'll be total and absolute control. Induced.
Oh, you mean if they... Oh, I got you. I got you. I got you. I'm still dealing with this frog. I feel like I'm going to say something that's going to come out ribbit, ribbit.
Yeah. So
I'm going to take a lozenger now and let you just continue with that thought, because I got a little confused about what you were saying with my preoccupation with my voice.
With all of this pharmacological-induced apathy.
No, there'll be no more protests.
Yeah, right. We're not going to have any protesters. We're not going to have any new ideas. We're not going to have anybody willing to take to the streets or question authority, because we're all going to be in this apathetic state, and it scares the hell out of me. We have to have people questioning. I mean, it was Einstein that said the important thing is to never, ever stop questioning. And when we induce this apathy, when this disinterest in life, we call that better? She's better now. No, she's worse than she's ever been. But he's not disruptive in the classroom. He's not crying anymore, and you call that better. We've just got to keep fighting. That's the bottom line. No matter what, we have to keep fighting.
This is so interesting. Let me address this idea about there won't be any more protests. You know, I think a lot of protesters do drugs. And we know in the 60s, protests were all around drugs. So I would say there might still be protests, but they'd be even more angry, more hostile, and more useless than a lot of the protesting we get. And people would be more and more being angry without being building their own lives, because these drugs do produce these other effects. They don't really... They will at times make people more passive and docile, but often, as my legal work has shown me again and again and again, and sometimes my clinical work, people end up getting impulsive and out of control and so on, because the drugs just aren't perfect, you know?
Right. But typically what we've seen is they take that out, you know, on first graders sitting in a classroom or people in a movie theater. That's where we're typically seeing these effects occur. And I don't know, that's a really interesting thought, that people in the 60s and 70s protesting, they probably were smoking a lot of pot. But see, me and you are different. I don't put pot in the same category at all as I do with antipsychotics or antidepressants. I think that the research clearly shows that they're working on completely different mechanisms in the brain. So maybe if we could really induce this apathy, this disinterest, that's what I was trying to get at, that we can make people not even, they don't have the gumption, like you said, to even be interested in the dog. If you don't have an interest in your wife or the dog, you're surely not going to have interest in, you know, driving 7 miles to a protest. Who cares?
Well, now let's get in even to more controversy, because let's talk about our differences about marijuana and pot, or pot, THC. I do believe that it's a very harmful drug, that it produces in people a subduing of their spirit, which they don't recognize as such, because it fools people like all drugs do. I've written in my articles and books about medication spellbinding. It makes people think that they're doing better, but it's another subduing agent. When young people come to me from Cornell and Ithaca College, like they do here in my office in Ithaca, and I find out they're on marijuana, as many of them are, I tell them, I'm not going to say I won't see you. I'll see you while you smoke dope, but you won't make the progress because you won't have all your feelings. You'll be dampened down. And also your memory is probably being impaired, at which time many of these young people perk up and say, I've been wondering about that. Yeah, your short-term memory and some of your focus. So I advise people to come off. And just about all the students I see do come off on their own. It doesn't take any fancy withdrawal process to go through. It lasts long enough in the blood that the withdrawal is pretty gradual. Most people, but not everybody, can come off. They can stop and go through a certain amount of discomfort and anxiety, but manage. So I think that pot is very insidious, and the whole deadhead culture was a deadhead culture, and that, yeah, human beings are so bright and sound, they're so strong that they can, you know, still carry on a lot of major functions smoking a lot of marijuana. But I do think that if you're smoking that every day, it is getting you through the day without having to deal with some sort of passionate issues in your personal life or your professional life or your life. I really think so. Your thoughts on it, Jeannie?
We're not as far apart as you think we are. I agree with everything you just said.
Okay.
I'll take it a step further. I believe alcohol does the exact same thing. You're doing better. You think you're doing better than you really are. It's a subduing agent. It dampens feelings. It impairs memory. You can still carry on getting you through the day, but you lose that passion. I agree 100%. My dream world would be that we can live without these drugs, but gosh, dang it, we like our drugs, don't we? Illegal.
I mean, we love them. I'm against drugs in principle, and I stay away from them, but I'd love to practice them. Life is hard.
I think
you take on all the challenges that Ginger and I take on, and boy, you like a respite.
Yes. But here's the thing. None of them work. Alcohol, pot, none of them work because then you have the rebound effect, and then you have the potential to become, you know, dependent on them. So I was just thinking about this before we talked. Do you know throughout the ages, human beings have always felt sadness, depression, anxiety, worry, whatever you want to call it. You know, we don't even have to go into those DSM names. We can just call it the human condition of sadness and loneliness and emptiness and worry and panic and all of those things. We've always had those. And what did we depend on? We depended on God and each other, our loved ones, in some sort of spiritual center. That's what we depended on, and that's what we're losing out on. Those two things are going by the wayside when we're depending on all these drugs.
Absolutely. And I really agree with you about alcohol. One of the things I see with alcohol is that, let's say the man comes home at night and he has two drinks, before dinner, or usually, sometimes with dinner or after dinner, or maybe as a third of a bottle of wine or something. And that has a profound dampening effect on his relationships to his wife and children.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the wife who does that same thing. Because you're taking your edge off of your feelings so you don't relate to your family for your feelings. So you don't get over your tiredness by picking up your 2-year-old or chasing your 4-year-old around or by getting back together with your husband or wife and being with them. And I think a lot of people get by one or both people having a few drinks in the evening. And often that then becomes a lot more because the drug wears off. That's its addictive quality. And you want more and more of it. And that you get more and more out of touch with yourself.
So basically what you're talking about, we've known this for centuries. Look what we're doing today. I mean, what we're doing today is truly insidious because we're having untrained professionals, and that's in quotation mark, professionals, for example, people working at Head Start that have no more training in child development than I have in radiometric dating. They have no training, and they're the ones referring these little tiny 2- and 3-year-old low-income children for psychiatric evaluation to the GP down the street. That's insidious.
Who knows even less maybe than they do.
Exactly.
About child development. Because at least they're working in a daycare.
That's right. That's insidious.
That setting kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes. That, and I just can't believe, speaking of apathy, that we know this is happening and we just kind of shrug our shoulders and go about our day. Okay, there's nothing we need to do about this. You know, this doesn't deserve our attention. That's why till the day I die, I will be working to rectify the situation we've got ourselves into. And that's why I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing, because you can't stop. You can't.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that, Jeannie. I'm with you 100%. Right now, this is very much a subject that's on my mind. I mean, obviously, anybody who knows me knows it's kind of always in the background. But very, very much on my mind is, how do we encapsulate, what language do we have to tell people that this is what all the drugs are doing to them? You know, that doesn't mean you can't go out and have a drink once in a while. It doesn't mean you can't smoke dope. It doesn't mean if you're into Indian culture or are Native American, you can't do a weekend, you know, for some creative purpose. I mean, all of that is a choice. But that if you are exposing yourself chronically to psychoactive substances, you're diminishing your humanity. Now, I keep searching for the right language, for the right words, and maybe we just need to keep saying it, or I do, for many, many, many different ways. But what has really struck me is that as I've researched more and more and seen more and more patients, God, I've been around on this earth for so long now, that there's the common effect that all the psychoactive substances are ultimately, you know, making us more docile in the eyes of others, which they prefer often, especially if we're struggling and or angry, and they're diminishing our experience of ourselves. Actually, they're diminishing everybody's experience of us. Just searching for those words that will ring a bell for people so they can say, aha, I don't want to diminish my experience of myself and everybody else. And diminishes everybody else's experience of me.
I think, I don't know what year you said this, but I remember it was one of the things that is forever seared in my brain, and that is when you said we're actually getting to the place where we prefer the chemically altered brain to the non-chemically altered brain. I don't know when you said it. I don't know what book I read it in, but it's seared in my brain, and that's where we are. And we're there with every single developmental stage. With our children, we don't want the two-year-old boy running amok, jumping, climbing, hitting, kicking, drug him. We don't want the 10-year-old. We don't want the all of these developmental stages that is normal, the adolescence that hates herself and she wants to die if Jim doesn't ask her out. We don't want any of that. We don't want the menopausal woman crying her head off or bitching her head off. We don't want the elderly man screaming at the nursing home saying, I want to go home. We don't want any of that. So we drug it all, and then they're better. And we say we're making progress.
I'm listening.
I'm
writing down little notes.
To me, I mean this. I'm not using hyperbole. To me, this is a sin. Taking normal developmental processes, I don't care what age you want to talk about, 2-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 90-year-olds, pathologizing normal-range human experiences, calling them a psychiatric illness, and requiring daily doses of mind-altering drugs, brain-crippling substances, to me, is a sin.
A crime, a sin, evil.
Evil. Evil. Evil. In the name of science, medicine, the people that raise their right hand and take a Hippocratic oath to do no harm. That's a crime. Am I too radical for you today, Dr. Bragan?
Are you kidding? You know, folks, you can find the article on my website under my scientific papers, but I've actually gone ahead and said that as ethical professionals, we should be working toward a ban on giving psychoactive substances to children. We ban giving them alcohol. We ban giving them marijuana. Neither of those drugs are as horribly damaging, not even alcohol. Neither of them is horribly damaging as most psychiatric drugs, which are tailored to cross the blood-brain barrier and muck about in your neurotransmitters. And we just have to ban the giving of psychoactive substances to children, and especially if the purpose is psychiatric or psychological, to control emotions or behavior. Maybe we give because there are antibiotics that have psychoactive effects. Accutane, has a high suicide rate and depression rate associated with it. But at least you can say, well, it's an antibiotic. It's for acne. That's horrible acne. And maybe we should use it, maybe not. I mean, there are a number of antibiotics that are associated with increasing agitation in some people, increasing depression in some people. But to actually purposely go in with the primary goal where you're going to drug until you get the effect, the psychoactive effect, rather than it being a side effect, I think is very critical here. I think I put that better than I have before.
I think you did. I think it's wonderful. And can you just imagine taking that a step further? Can you imagine all the children lining up at the nurse's office at the local school, and they're all waiting for their doses of Jack Daniels? We would be in such an uproar. And as you just said very eloquently, is that these substances are less harmful than your Ritalin, than your Prozac, and we're lining them up, giving them their pills, and no one's saying a word.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I really think this is an important idea, that drugging somebody to the point of getting the psychoactive effect is very different. I think this has been confusing to people and even to me. Very different than the psychoactive effect being a side effect that's unintended.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that case, you're not purposely continually raising it to the level that it is toxic to behave, so toxic to behavior. Oh, boy.
We have to get ourselves out of this mess. But see, as long as there is an economic incentive to label and drug as many people as possible, we're going to still be fighting the David and Goliath fight. That's the David and Goliath fight. That's what we're going to still be up against as long as we keep providing economic incentives to label and drug our children in schools.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how many parents really understand that when they get that initial call from the school that Joey's not doing so good. Can you come in? And you think you're going to go in and meet Mrs. Johnson because that's who called. And instead you go and there's seven or eight people sitting there, the principal and the counselor and the third, la, 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 la. And you're so intimidated, you don't know what to do. And so they start talking to you about, we've got to do these assessments if we're going to get Joey the help he needs. And, of course, you're going to sign the paper. And then they have full throttle to assess for anything they want to. And then here comes the federal monies into the school, into the individual school. I just don't think American parents know that. Maybe I'm ignorant. Maybe I'm naive. But I don't think the majority know that there's money in getting their children diagnosed and drugged in public schools.
I'm certain most people aren't thinking about that. They're too trusting.
Too trusting. And it's happening in preschools, and it's happening in Head Starts. They're getting more federal block monies, federal block grants. The more they can label, and these are low-income children who might be more vulnerable than any of the other children, and this is the best we can do for them. You're not going to convince me of that.
This is so important. There's a lot that we could say about how the funding takes place with the children. do you get to see in practice? But I'd like to stay with the kids right now. Do you get to see in your work the effect of drugs on your students?
Absolutely. I'm so glad
let's
you asked me
about
that.
Let's really talk. I didn't expect this at all, but let's just talk about this this whole way of seeing what the drugs do to people. What do you see with the kids? So they're not kids. I mean, you're students. But what do you see? What effects do you see?
When I first started being a professor many years ago, I did not have one college student, not one, who was on a psychiatric drug. Not one. Today, 2017, I'm going to say it's between, depending on what class it is, but between 30 and 50%. And the stories that they
tell
share.
Tell me that again. I harumphed when you said the percent.
Yeah. It's about, I would say between 30 and 40, maybe 30 to 50% of my students are on some kind of psychiatric drug.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. The stories that they share, particularly about trying to get off, this is a common theme that no physician, nobody is telling them the hell they're going to go through when they try to get off their Prozac, when they try to get off their, you know, and to me, it's an informed consent issue. As a matter of fact, a student today brought her, I'm always talking to the students about read the inserts, you know, read the inserts. So she brought some antidepressants to school today. They were her roommates. And she showed us that what she got at the pharmacy was just a piece of paper. And basically it said, talk to your doctor. Can cause some, you know, insomnia, stomach upset. And she said, Dr. Stolzer, is this the insert you're talking about? I said, no, you guys, I'm talking about that thing that you pull out. You know, and it's really tiny writing. She said, I don't think that came with this. She said, she said there was no insert. So tell me, Dr. Bragan, is there some way you can get around this now that you don't have to put an insert in a drug? It's got to be against federal law, isn't it?
No, the only place you have to put inserts is in the larger package that it comes in to the pharmacist. I don't think inserts are even going. Maybe they go inside boxes, but no, if you get a prescription, you definitely don't get a, you definitely do not get the package insert at all anymore. But I think if it comes packaged, and I don't know what the rule is, I'll try to find that out. But if
yes,
it comes packaged in some way, like I just got some medication that came in a small box, and inside the box was the package insert, had everything in it.
So it did come with an insert, but it's in the outside big box. That's what you're saying.
No, this was in it was a box with a little apparatus in it that I needed to treat a cold.
Okay.
And it was, it was small. And inside was the package insert for the device. I think it has to do with whether it's in a boxed package of some sort, in which case it has to come in. But if the pharmacist is delivering the pills, there's no package insert.
Unbelievable.
And I'm not sure what the rules are, but I do know that I do get package inserts on some items that are come in little boxes. But if you go and just get a medication, the pharmacist, you don't. And the pharmacists are, it's suggested in the label, which is the the package insert. It's also called the full prescribing information, which I think makes clearer to people what it is. It's mm-hmm. the FDA-approved full prescribing information. Now, that has attached to it nowadays for most psychiatric drugs an addition to it called the medication guide.
Yeah.
The medication guide is full of threatening things. The medication guide, for example, for all antidepressants mentions mania, call the doctor if you get manic, if you get suicidal. It even says if you have violent, feelings or violent impulses, call the doctors. So it mentions aggression and violence and all these things that you should be aware of. And it's recommended inside the full prescribing information to give the guide not only to the patient, even with adults, but also to the parents. It says to the patient and the family. If you're a child, surely the patient and the family. And in fact, pharmacies do not give out the medication guide, even though they're urged to by the FDA, and doctors rarely do. The pharmacies buy a substitute for it that is much more shallow, which gets stapled on to the item of the bag you pick up usually. And then on that bag stapled to it will be some comments about, you know, it won't say beware of tardive dyskinesia, a terrible disabling disorder that will ruin your life. It'll say sometimes occur movement disorders or something like that.
So what you're saying then is, in essence, this negates informed consent.
Absolutely.
Informed consent doesn't exist because it can't exist. If you don't know, how can you give your informed consent? That's what I'm learning from my students. They had no idea what they were taking. None. But they're all very familiar now with the PDR, and they're lucky because they can get it on their phone. I still am from the old school and keep one on my desk that I go. I like books. I don't like phones. But they can look up things on their phone, much more informed than many people.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where when people in my practice or people who – not my practice, but people who are coming to me for legal work – they often Googled, and that's when they finally got the information. And they may get the information by Googling antipsychotic drugs, weird movements or something, because often you can get right to it if you just describe what you're seeing on Google.
Exactly.
Or they might Google antipsychotics information from a critical doctor or something, and they'll get Bregan. But Googling is a very, very good way just to talk about it. I remember once talking to a neurologist whom I'd gone to see with a family member, and I said, well, there's a lot of information out there on this drug now that it's really causing people a lot of emotional problems out on the internet now. And it was a pain medication. And he said, I prefer evidence-based medicine to the internet. Well, I didn't want to say to him, I didn't get into a big thing with him, but I did say that actually a lot of the even serious adverse effects are showing up first on the internet.
They are.
And that evidence-based medicine is a code word for drug company clinical trials. But that's the fact of the matter.
It is the fact of the matter, but informed consent is being negated because it can't be occurring if people don't know what they're consenting to.
That's right.
And I've said this over and over, and I know this is kind of a radical concept, but I've said it, and I've said it for years. If the terrorists truly, truly want to bring us to our knees, it's not going to occur with bombs and airplanes. It's not. Somehow they have to figure out how to induce apathy. And at the very beginning of your show, you told us exactly how we're doing that.
Well, all they need to do is put up some sort of right across the border, or maybe pop-up. What they need is to put pop-up, you know, those pop-up restaurants and things, do pop-up pop-up stores with free alcohol, marijuana, Xanax, and Paxil.
Yeah. Yes, Ed.
And it'll be the end of America.
It will be, but have you thought about this one? We don't need to put up those pop-up stores because what is it right now? How many people are on psychiatric drugs? And all we need to do, they just need to disable our computers for about I don't know, a week or two. Think of people going through the withdrawal from these drugs. What's going to happen when you don't have your Ambien, Paxil, and Luvox? What is going to happen to you in the next week? You will be on your knees.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to bring that up, but that's the reality we're living in.
It is. Tell me what you've seen. I don't think we got to that. In the actual effects of the drugs on your students, I imagine some of them come off their meds during your classes.
Yes, they do, but I'm...
Do you see much change? Do the students see much change in themselves? Because I want people to know these drugs really do change you without your knowing it.
I pound on this point, and I'm loud, and I make it very, very clear. These are not antibiotics that you can just decide tomorrow. I don't think I'm going to take that today. These are serious, chemically altering, brain disabling drugs. You have to have medical intervention to help you very slowly wean off these drugs. This isn't a game. This isn't a joke. This is real. So I pound that point in. This isn't something we just say, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. So, yes, I have seen so many. I remember this one student coming in. I will never forget this in my life. She was on 13 different psychiatric drugs. She started at age 7, and this was when she was 32 years old. So I helped her, blah, blah, blah. But I remember her coming into my office, and she sat down, and she looked at me, and she started crying, and she said, I'm free. I'm finally free. She knew she could live a well-adjusted, happy life without these. She was no longer addicted to all these drugs that, by the way, a physician had prescribed her. She wasn't, you know, doing methamphetamines on the street. She went to get some help for emotional pain and suffering, and that's the help she got. But she eventually became free. And that seared into my brain, too, that seeing that look of her freedom from these drugs. Because we have really indoctrinated this generation with, you have a chemical imbalance. You can't live without these. This is lifelong. These are lifetime paying patients. They believe that. They believe it. Oh, God, a student this morning, I have to tell you about this. I'm sorry, I have to tell you. He comes to class, and he very rarely talks because there's so many females in the class. But today he thought he could, and he said, I have a psychology class, and we just got our study notes for the test. I said, yeah? He said, look at this slide they gave us. It says serotonin deficiency equals depression. So he's been
golly.
It says it. I saw it. So he's been one of my students before. So he raised his hand, and he said, very respectfully, can you please tell me, psychology professor, how we measure the serotonin in the brain? Psychology professor admitted, well, we can't, but we've got enough data to know that it's a serotonin imbalance that's causing your depression. And my student said, he's 19 years old, he's a kid. He said, if you can't measure something, how would you possibly know if it was imbalanced? She didn't know what to say to him, but it's a really good question.
Well, I went through this very recently with a friend of mine who was under attack from she's a professor at a university, and she got under attack from some sort of PR person at another university, very threatening, because she'd published some work about there isn't no such thing as a biochemical imbalance. And I told her to write back to this PR who had a PhD in psychology or something and say, just send me 3 articles that will be convincing that people have a biochemical imbalance associated with any psychiatric disorder whatsoever. And he wrote back, that's stupid. what about all the studies on brain biochemistry, and what about how the drugs, lithium, which is such a toxin, and how the drugs help people? So again, you know, there were all these studies on brain chemistry. He just didn't happen to know three of them. And he fell back on the old thing. Well, you know, alcohol helps people. Marijuana helps people. People swear by cocaine. That has nothing to do with whether the drugs are good for them.
Right. You feel better when you – yeah, that's right. I take it a step further. I actually say to my students, an unbiased, peer-reviewed journal article. I don't want to see some article funded by Cigna Geigy. I don't. To me, that's not science. That's propaganda.
Yeah, well, so yeah, and that, you know, you can deal with that if they come up with one. But, you know, on this particular issue of biochemical imbalances, they're not even going to have a, you know, they're not even going to have a GlaxoSmithKline or Geigy or anybody. There aren't any.
So that's, I really feel sometimes like, my God, you know, this is such an insurmountable problem. You're beating your head against the wall. And then I look into the faces of these young people who are demanding answers, demanding research, demanding answers in the form of quantifiable scientific data. And I do have hope. I absolutely have hope that we can swing this pendulum back the other way. I do.
Well, we are definitely, I know we're turning back the pendulum in that a large, large percentage of the population thinks what's going on with drugs is nuts. I hear that all the time from people I meet who don't know me. One of the things I like about living in small town area is that a lot of the people I know are working people. They're plumbers and electricians and handymen and in the community that I live in out here, those folks can be your friends. Back in Bethesda, Maryland, there was such suspicion between the working class and the homeowner that you were just always watching them. I mean, it was really interesting to me to see the difference here. When I got out in the country, at my house, and we had a workman come in first or second day to repair something, and I asked him if he'd like a cup of coffee when he was done with his repairs, and we sat and talked for 2 hours. You know, that never happened to me in my entire existence in Bethesda, Maryland.
Yeah.
But what I find from folks is that they know right away, a lot of folks, that this is wrong. They know it now. The problem is that the drug companies, while we are garnering an increasing number of people who understand these things, the drug companies are garnering even more who are hooked on these things. So it's kind of like the Berlin Wall. Hopefully, after a while, people will just say, I'm not even going to guard the wall if people start running over it. They're just going to not defend this anymore.
What are we going to do? Some of these people have been on these psychiatric drugs since they were 18 months old. It's exactly what you just said. Have you noticed this, too? This has come from a couple of my students. They've started working in health and human services areas, and they have noticed this increase, this uptake, in people that have dementia, Alzheimer's-type symptoms in their 30s and 40s. And what the common denominator is these are all people who started these drugs at 3, 4, and 5 years old.
Somebody's got to write these observations down. I'm sure that's happening. We now know, Jeannie, by the way, I've been so into this discussion that I haven't even taken a minute and reminded people. I'm talking with my dear friend, you can probably tell that, Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R, and she's at professor at Nebraska Kearney. That's Kearney, actually. But it's spelled K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, Nebraska Kearney, right, Jeannie?
Kearney, that's right.
And she's a professor of child and adolescent development. Golly, I'm really enjoying this hour. This is like one of my few hours that have been totally spontaneous in the sense we went off on something totally unplanned. Entirely.
We did. It was totally unplanned.
And I really like this. Can you think of more just to throw into this pot about how bad these drugs are? Oh, I know what I wanted to say. That the data on all classes of drugs producing dementia is just piling up.
Piling up.
We don't
up.
Have it on all the individual drugs, but we know that the antipsychotic drugs cause brain damage, cell death, dementia over time, and it may begin fairly early on. We know that all of the benzos, tranquilizers, cause dementia. It may not be everybody, but it's a significant measurable percentage of people. We know the stimulants are doing that, causing shrinkage of brain tissue. Dozens of studies that touch on that issue. We know that the lithium, a key mood stabilizer, is like taking a very potent neurotoxin your whole life. And we know basically that psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins.
Absolutely,
they're neurotoxins 100%. By any definition under the sun. And all the other research on neurotoxins, not on the psych drug, all the other research on neurotoxins assumes that if you're exposed to a neurotoxin, that is something poisonous to brain cells, something that harms brain cells. Neurotoxin harms brain cells, put more poignantly, poisons brain cells, that you're going to ruin brain cells, at least some of them, over time. So
this is no question. And the earlier you start it, the more potential for atrophy in the brain. That's a fact. So what are we doing with our children? And who's out there speaking for them? We are, Dr. Bragan. We are. And we're not going to be silenced.
And we're not alone.
And we're not alone.
There's a new book coming out called The Sedated Society. And in fact, in March, I have a chapter in it. Most of the people in the book are from Great Britain. And every week in March, it's edited by a fellow named Davies, whom I've had on my show. By the way, Fix, don't forget that you can go to Bragan.com. You can look up the radio show. You can find it right at the top list of my, you know, important recent events or accomplishments. Or you can search it. We got a good search mechanism now. It's a really updated website. And you can go and put a name in, like Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, or Bragan, or whatever, for the radio show. We get me on every radio show. You can put in for Jeannie Stolzer. Put in Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. And you'll get all the time she's been on the show. So you can also go in there and look up Peter Goetze and Joanna Moncrief and other good people. Well, Peter Goetze and Joanna Moncrief and Davies and some other very good people, Bob Whitaker, we all have chapters in this book called The Sedated Society. My only regret is Jeannie doesn't, but I wasn't in charge of the book. I had no input into who went into it.
When does it come out?
It's coming out in the next few weeks, and in March 1st, starting March 1st, every week for 10 weeks on my show, it's going to go in consecutive order, when possible, with somebody from the show for an hour. So we're going to have the book coming out, and then I'm going to do a radio shows on each chapter of the book. And it's going to provide a nice piece of data for the world to hang on to. I just thought of it last week, and all the big name folks have already signed up. I think it's the lesser known people who may be nervous and haven't signed up yet. They're very, very, very glad that I'm doing this. The editor obviously couldn't be happier. And I don't blame him. I mean, I wish I could do this for myself. Maybe I would with one of my books, do a every night on a chapter for a month or 2 months. So we're lining that up, and you can also go back and hear Jeannie's earlier shows with me by going to Bragan.com and looking up anybody you think that might be on it. I don't know any other way to search for who's on my shows. I don't think you can do it on anywhere else. If I'm wrong, somebody let me know, because I'm happy to have it searched elsewhere, too.
Well, I'm so glad I got to talk with you again.
I think we have 2 minutes left, So share 2 minutes of your spirit. How's that for a challenge? What do you want to say?
I want to say that the way we raise our kids and honor our kids really, really, really matters. And that parents know their children completely and totally. A psychiatrist doesn't. A teacher doesn't. Listen to your heart. Honor them for the fabulous, wonderful, incredible spirits that they are. If they're having trouble, help them through this. Get them the help they need. And the help doesn't mean drugs. The help means helping them the way we've always helped kids. They're ours. They're our responsibility. They're our loves. And we can do better than we're doing. That's what I want to say.
Thank you, dear. Now, do you want people to be able to get in touch with you?
Sure, yes.
How would they do that?
You can contact me at Stolzer, JM@unk.edu, or you can call me at 308-865-8234.
Jeannie, I just love talking with you. I'm really glad about today's show, and we should do more shows where we just start talking and see what happens.
Yeah, that's and what we did today, just go and go and go. Yes.
Yeah, we got it on a really good theme, so it's not scattered. It's a job well done. It's a pleasure to know you, and keep up your marvelous work, tell everybody in your department I miss them, and I look forward to another invitation someday to come and talk at the university. You've got a great group of people there. You're really well situated with a wonderful group of people.
You've got to come back, and thank you so very much for what you do for the world, Dr. Bragan. You are appreciated more than you know.
Thank you very much, Jeannie. And I'm waiting for the music to start, feeling like I'm running out of loving words here.
Here it comes. Love you.
Here it comes. Thank you, Jesse, my wonderful engineer, for the music. And folks, have a great week and keep on listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. Bye now.